We, a novel by Eugene Zumyatin, an Adult Brain audiobook production, read to you by Graham Dunlop. Yevgeny Ivanovich Zamyatin, 1884 to 1937, was a Russian author of science fiction and political satire. He is most famous for his 1921 novel, We, a story set in a dystopian future police state. Despite having been a prominent old Bolshevik, Zumyatin was deeply disturbed by the policies pursued by the CPSU following the October Revolution. In 1921, We became the first work banned by the Soviet Censorship Board. Ultimately, Zumyatin arranged for We to be smuggled to the West for publication. The subsequent outrage this sparked within the party and the Union of Soviet Writers led directly to Zamyatin's successful request for exile from his homeland. Due to his use of literature to criticize Soviet society, Zumyatin has been referred to as one of the first Soviet dissidents. Early life. Zumyatin was born in Lebedyan, Tambov, Governorate, 300 kilometers south of Moscow. His father was a Russian Orthodox priest and schoolmaster, and his mother a musician. In a 1922 essay, Zumyatin recalled, "You will see a very lonely child without companions of his own age, on his stomach, over a book, or under the piano on which his mother is playing Chopin. He may have had synesthesia, since he gave letters and sounds qualities. For instance, he saw the letter as having pale, cold, and light blue qualities. He studied naval engineering in St. Petersburg from 1902 until 1908, during which time he joined the Bolsheviks. He was arrested during the Russian Revolution of 1905 and sent into internal exile in Siberia. However, he escaped and returned to St. Petersburg, where he lived illegally before moving to the Grand Duchy of Finland in 1906 to finish his studies. After returning to Russia, he began to write fiction as a hobby. He was arrested and exiled a second time in 1911, but amnestied in 1913. His story, Uyedznia, a provincial tale in 1913, which satirized life in a small Russian town, brought him a degree of fame. The next year, he was tried for maligning the Imperial Russian military in his story, Na Kulichkak, at the World's End. He continued to contribute articles to various Marxist newspapers. After graduating as an engineer for the Imperial Russian Navy, Zumyatin worked professionally at home and abroad. In 1916, he was sent to the United Kingdom to supervise the construction of icebreakers at the shipyards in Walker and Wallsend while living in Newcastle upon Tyne. Literary career. Zumyatin later recalled, "In England, I built ships, looked at ruined castles, listened to the thud of bombs dropped by German zeppelins, and wrote The Islanders. I regret that I did not see the February Revolution and know only the October Revolution. I returned to Petersburg, past German submarines in a ship with lights out, wearing a life belt the whole time, just in time for October. This is the same as never having been in love and waking up one morning already married for 10 years or so." Zumyatin's The Islanders satirized English life and the similarly themed A Fisher of Men were both published after his return to Russia in late 1917. After the Russian Revolution of 1917, he edited several journals, lectured on writing, and edited Russian translations of works by Jack London, O. Henry, H. G. Wells, and others. Zumyatin originally supported the October Revolution, but opposed the increasing use of censorship which followed. His works became increasingly satirical and critical toward the CPSU. Although he supported them before they came to power, he slowly came to disagree more and more with their policies. particularly those regarding censorship of the arts. In his 1921 essay, I Am Afraid, Zamyatin wrote, "True literature can only exist when it is created not by diligent and reliable officials, but by madmen, hermits, heretics, dreamers, rebels, and skeptics." This attitude made his position increasingly difficult as the 1920s wore on. In 1923, Zamyatin arranged for the manuscript of his novel We to be smuggled to E.P. Dutton and Company in New York City. After being translated into English by Gregory Zylberg, the novel was published in 1924. Then, in 1927, Zamyatin went much further. He smuggled the original Russian text to Mark Lovick Slonim, 1894-1976, then editor of a Russian emigre journal and publishing house based in Prague. To the fury of the state, copies of the Slonim edition began being smuggled back to the USSR and secretly passed from hand to hand. Zamyatin's dealing with Western publishers triggered a mass offensive by the Soviet state against him. As a result, he was blacklisted from publishing anything in his homeland. We has often been discussed as a political satire aimed at the police state of the Soviet Union. There are many other dimensions, however. It may variously be examined as 1. A polemic against the optimistic scientific socialism of H.G. Wells, whose works Zamyatin had previously published, and with the heroic verses of the Russian proletarian poets. 2. As an example of expressionist theory. And 3. As an illustration of the archetype theories of Carl Jung as applied to literature. George Orwell believed that Aldous Huxley's Brave New World, 1932, must be partly derived from We. However, in a 1962 letter to Christopher Collins, Huxley says that he wrote Brave New World as a reaction to H.G. Wells's utopias long before he had heard of We. Kurt Vonnegut said that in writing Player Piano, 1952, he cheerfully ripped off the plot of Brave New World, whose plot had been cheerfully ripped off from Yevgeny Zamyatin's We. In 1994, We received a Prometheus Award in the Libertarian Futurist Society's Hall of Fame category. In addition to We, Zamyatin also wrote a number of short stories in fairy tale form that constituted satirical criticism of communist ideology. In one story, the mayor of a city decides that to make everyone happy, he must make everyone equal. The mayor then forces everyone, himself included, to live in a big barrack, then to shave their heads to be equal to the bald, and then to become mentally disabled to equate intelligence downward. This plot is very similar to that of The New Utopia, 1891, by Jerome K. Jerome, whose collected works were published 3 times in Russia before 1917. In its turn, Kurt Vonnegut's short story, Harrison Bergeron, 1961, bears distinct resemblances to Zamyatin's tale. Max Eastman, an American communist who had similarly broken with his former beliefs, described the Politburo's campaign against Zamyatin in his book Artists in Uniform, Escape and Death. In 1931, Zamyatin appealed directly to Joseph Stalin, requesting permission to leave the Soviet Union. In this letter, Zamyatin wrote, "I do not wish to conceal that the basic reason for my request for permission to go abroad with my wife is my hopeless position here as a writer, the death sentence that has been pronounced upon me as a writer here at home." With the encouragement of Maxim Gorky, Stalin agreed to Zamyatin's request. Zamyatin settled with his wife in Paris, where he collaborated with French film director Jean Renoir. Renoir's 1936 adaptation of Gorky's The Lower Depths was co-written by Zamyatin. Yevgeny Zamyatin died in poverty of a heart attack in 1937. Only a small group of friends were present for his burial. However, one of the mourners was his Russian language publisher, Mark Slonim, who had befriended the Zamyatins. Zamyatin's grave can be found in Cimetière de Thay, south of Paris. Wikipedia. First entry. Topics. Announcement. The Wisest of Lines. An epic poem. I am merely copying out here word for word what was printed today in the State Gazette. In 120 days from now, the building of the Integral will be finished. Near at hand is the great, historic hour when the first Integral will lift off into space. 1,000 years ago, your heroic forebears subjugated the whole of planet Earth to the power of one state. It is for you to accomplish an even more glorious feat. By means of the glass, the electric, the fire-breathing Integral to integrate the indefinite equation of the universe. It is for you to place the beneficial yoke of reason round the necks of the unknown beings who inhabit other planets. Still living, it may be, in the primitive state known as freedom. If they will not understand that we are bringing them a mathematically infallible happiness, we shall be obliged to force them to be happy. But before taking up arms, we shall try what words can do. In the name of the benefactor, all numbers of one state are hereby informed of the following. Everyone who feels himself capable of doing so is required to compose treatises, epic poems, manifestos, odes, or other compositions dealing with the beauty and grandeur of one state. This will be the first cargo transported by the Integral. Long live one state. Long live the numbers. Long live the benefactor. As I write this, I feel my cheeks burning. Yes, to integrate completely the colossal equation of the universe. Yes, to unbend the wild curve, to straighten it tangentially, asymptotically, to flatten it to an undeviating line. Because the line of one state is a straight line. The great, divine, precise, wise, straight line. The wisest of all lines. I, D-503, builder of the Integral, I am only one of the mathematicians of one state. My pen, accustomed to figures, is powerless to create the music of assonance and rhyme. I shall attempt nothing more than to note down what I see, what I think, or, to be more exact, what we think. That's right, we. And let this we be the title of these records. But this surely will be a derivative of our life, of the mathematically perfect life of one state. And if that is so, then won't this be, of its own accord, whatever I may wish, an epic? It will. I believe and I know that it will. I feel my cheeks burning as I write this. This is probably like what a woman feels when she first senses in her the pulse of a new little person, still tiny and blind. It's me, and at the same time, it's not me. And for long months to come, she will have to nourish it with her own juice, her own blood, and then tear it painfully out of herself and lay it at the feet of one state. But I am ready. Like all of us, or nearly all of us, I am ready. Second entry. Topics, ballet, square harmony, X. It's spring. From beyond the green wall, from the wild plains out of sight in the distance, the wind is carrying the honeyed yellow pollen of some flower. The sweet pollen dries the lips, you keep running your tongue over them, and every woman you meet, and every man too, of course, must have these sweet lips. This somewhat interferes with logical thought. And then, what a sky! Blue, unsullied by a single cloud. What primitive taste the ancients must have had if their poets were inspired by those absurd, untidy clumps of mist, idiotically jostling one another about. I love, and I am sure that I am right in saying we love, only such a sky as this one today, sterile and immaculate. On days like this, the whole world seems to have been cast of the same immovable and everlasting glass as the green wall, as all of our structures. On days like this, you can see into the deep blue depth of things. You see their hitherto unsuspected, astonishing equations. You see this in the most ordinary, the most everyday things. Here, take this for instance. Just this morning, I was at the hangar where the Integral is being built, and suddenly I caught sight of the equipment. The regulator globes, their eyes closed, oblivious, were twirling around. The cranks were glistening and bending to the left and right. The balance beam was proudly heaving its shoulders. The bit of the router was squatting athletically to the beat of some unheard music. I suddenly saw the whole beauty of this grandiose mechanical ballet, flooded with the light of the lovely blue-eyed sun. But why, my thoughts continued, why beautiful? Why is the dance beautiful? Answer, because it is non-free movement, because all the fundamental significance of the dance lies precisely in its aesthetic subjection, its ideal non-freedom. And if it is true that our ancestors gave themselves over to dancing at the most inspired moments of their lives, religious mysteries, military parades, that can mean only one thing. That from time immemorial, the instinct of non-freedom has been an organic part of man, and that we, in our present-day life, are only deliberately... I'll have to finish this later. The intercom screen just clicked. I left my eyes. 0-90, of course. In half a minute, she'll be here herself, coming to get me for our walk. Dear O, it always struck me that she looks like her name. About 10 centimeters shorter than the maternal norm, and therefore sort of rounded all over, and the pink O of her mouth open to greet every word I say. And also, she has a sort of circular, puffy crease at her wrist, the way children have. When she came in, my logical flywheel was still humming away inside me, and the inertia carried me on to start talking about the formula I'd just come up with. The one containing us and the machines and the dance. Wonderful, isn't it? I asked.
Yes, wonderful. It's spring.
0-90 smiled at me rosily. There, how's that for you? Spring. She's right away on spring. Women. I didn't say a word. We went down. The avenue was jammed. When the weather's like this, we usually take an extra walk during the personal hour after lunch. As usual, all the pipes of the music factory were singing the One State March. The numbers were marching along in step in neat ranks of four, hundreds and thousands of them in their sky-blue unis, with a golden badge on each chest bearing each one's state number. And I, or rather we, our four, were one of the innumerable waves in that mighty flood. To my left was 0-90, if one of my hirsute ancestors from 1,000 years back were writing this, he'd probably modify her with that funny word, my. On my right were two numbers I didn't know, a female and a male. Blessedly blue sky, little babies, suns on each badge. Faces undimmed by anything so crazy as thought. Rays, you see. Everything made out of some kind of uniform, radiant, smiling matter. And the beat of the brass, tra-ta-ta, tra-ta-ta. Brass paces gleaming in the sun, and every pace carries you up higher and higher into the dizzying blue. And then, just the way it was this morning in the hangar, I saw again, as though right then for the first time in my life, I saw everything. The unalterably straight streets, the sparkling glass of the sidewalks, the divine parallelepipeds, of the transparent dwellings, the squared harmony of our gray-blue ranks. And so I felt that I, not generations of people, but I myself, I had conquered the old god and the old life. I myself had created all this, and I'm like a tower. I'm afraid to move my elbow for fear of shattering the walls, the cupolas, the machines. And then there came a moment, a leap across the centuries from plus to minus. I recalled association by contrast, apparently. I suddenly recall the picture in the museum, one of the avenues they had back then after 20 centuries. A stunningly garish, mixed-up crush of people, wheels, animals, posters, trees, colors, birds. And they say it really was like that. It could have been like that. It all struck me as so unlikely, so idiotic, that I couldn't help it. I burst out laughing. And suddenly there was an echo, laughter, from the right. I turned. Before my eyes were teeth. White, uncommonly white, sharp teeth. And a woman's face that I didn't know. "I'm sorry," she said. "By the way you were looking at everything, it was inspired. Like you were some god out of myth on the seventh day of creation. I think you believe you created me too, and you and nobody else. I'm very flattered." All this with a straight face. I'd even say with a kind of respect. Maybe she knows I'm the builder of the integral. But I don't know, something about her eyes or brows, some kind of odd irritating X that I couldn't get at all, a thing I couldn't express in numbers. For some reason, this embarrassed and slightly confused me, and I started trying to make up some logical explanation for why I was laughing. It was perfectly clear that this contrast, this unbridgeable gulf between today and back then. Unbridgeable? But why? What white teeth? You could build a little bridge across the gulf. Just imagine, a drum, battalions, ranks. They used to have all that, too. So it follows that... "Well, yes, that's right," I shouted. This was an amazing example of mental crossover. She said, almost in my very words, exactly what I'd been writing before going to walk. You see, even thoughts. That's because no one is one, but only one of. We're so identical. She said, "Are you sure?" I saw the sharp angle her brows made when she lifted them toward her temples, like the sharp horns of an X, and for some reason I got confused again. I looked to the right, to the left, and she was to my right, slender, sharp, tough, and springy as a whip. 1-330. Now I saw her number. To my left was 0, completely different, everything about her round with the babyish crease on her arm. And at the end of our group of 4 was a male number that I didn't know. He bent in 2 places like the letter S. We were all different. That one on the right, 1-330, must have noticed my confused look. "Yes, too bad," she said with a sigh. That "too bad" was absolutely called for, no doubt about it. But again, there was something in her face or her voice. So I said very abruptly, which wasn't like me at all, "Nothing's too bad. Science is going forward, and it's clear that maybe not right away, but in 50 or 100 years.
Even the noses on everybody."
"Yes, the noses," I was practically shouting. "Once there's some, never mind what reason for envy. Once I have a button nose and someone else has..."
"Well, now, if it comes to that, your nose is even rather classical, as they used to say in the old days. But as for your hands..."
"No, come on now. Show me. Show me your hands." I can't stand people looking at my hands. They're hairy, shaggy, some kind of stupid throwback. I stuck out my hands and said with as steady a voice as I could manage, "A monkey's hands." She looked at my hands and then at my face.
"Yes, there's an extraordinarily curious harmony."
She weighed me with her eyes as if I were on a scales, and her brows once more looked like horns.
"He's assigned to me,"
said 0-90, her mouth smiling rosily. It would have been better if she'd not said anything, of course. That was completely beside the point. Besides that dear, oh, how should I put this? Her tongue isn't set at the right speed. The MPS, motions per second, of the tongue must always be a little less than the MPS of thought, and never the other way around. At the end of the avenue, the clock on the accumulator tower was booming out 17:00. The personal hour was over. 1-330 was walking away with that S-shaped male number. His face was the kind that inspires a sort of respect, and I now saw that it was even a rather familiar face.
I'd met him somewhere. Can't recall just now. In parting, 1-330 smiled at me in the same X-like way and said, "Drop by to see me day after tomorrow in Auditorium 112. I shrugged and said, "If I get the order for the auditorium you mention." Why, she was so sure of herself I couldn't see, but she said, "You'll get it." This woman was just as irritating to me as an irrational term that accidentally creeps into your equation and can't be factored out. And I was glad to be alone with my dear Zero, even if not for long. We went hand in hand across four lines of avenues. At the corner, she was to go right. I left. "I'd like so much to come to your place today and let the blinds down. Today, right this minute," said Zero and shyly looked up at me with her round crystal blue eyes. She's a funny one, but what could I say? She was with me only yesterday, and she knows as well as I do that our next sex day is the day after tomorrow. It's just more of her thought getting ahead of itself, like a spark that fires too early in the ignition, which can do some harm at times. Saying goodbye, I kissed her twice. No, I'll tell the truth. Three times on those wonderful blue eyes of hers that not the least little cloud ever troubled. Third entry. Topics. Coat. Wall. Tables. I've looked over what I wrote yesterday and I see it wasn't as clear as it should be. It's perfectly clear for any of us, I mean. But who knows? Maybe you unknown people who'll get my notes when the integral brings them. Maybe you've read the great book of civilization only up to the page our ancestors reached about 900 years ago. Maybe you don't even know the basics, like the table of hours. Personal hours, maternal norm, green wall, benefactor. It feels funny to me, and at the same time it's very hard to talk about all this. It's just as if a writer of the 20th century, for instance, had to explain in his novel what he meant by jacket or apartment or wife. Still, if his novel was translated for savages, there's no way he could write jacket without putting in a note. I'm sure a savage would look at jacket and think, "What's that for? Just something else to carry." I think you'll probably look at me the same way when I tell you that not one of us, ever since the 200 Years' War, has ever been on the other side of the Green Wall. But, my dear readers, you'll have to do just a little thinking. It helps a lot because, you know, all human history as far back as we know it is the history of moving from nomadic life to a more settled way of life. So doesn't it follow that the most settled form of life, ours, is by the same token the most perfect form of life, ours? If people used to wander over the earth from one end to the other, that only happened in prehistoric times, when there were nations and wars and trade. And discoveries of this and that America. But why do it now? Who needs it? I'll admit that people did not take to this settled way of life right away and without any trouble. When the 200 Years' War destroyed all the roads and the grass covered them over, during that first time it probably seemed very uncomfortable living in cities that were cut off from one another by all the tangled green stuff. But what of that? After man's tail fell off, it was probably some little while before he learned to shoo away the flies without a tail. I don't doubt that during the first time he probably missed his tail. But now, can you even imagine yourself with a tail? Or can you imagine yourself walking down the street naked without your jacket? Maybe you still run around in jackets. Well, it's the same here. I can't imagine a city that isn't girdled about with a green wall. I can't imagine a life that isn't clad in the numerical robes of the table. The table, at this very minute, from the wall of my room, its purple figures on their golden ground are looking down at me sternly and tenderly, straight in the eyes. I can't help thinking of what the ancients called an icon. And I feel like composing a poem or a prayer, which is the same thing. Oh, why am I not a poet, so that I might celebrate you properly, O table, O heart and pulse of one state? All of us as schoolchildren, and you too perhaps, used to read that greatest of all monuments of ancient literature that has come down to us, the railroad timetable. But set even this next to the table, and what you'll see is graphite and diamond. They're both one and the same element, C, carbon. But how eternal, transparent, and brilliant is the diamond? Who doesn't catch his breath when he ruffles through the pages of the railroad timetable? But the table of hours, it turns each one of us right there in broad daylight into a steel six-wheeled epic hero. Every morning, with six-wheeled precision at the very same hour and the very same minute, we get up, millions of us, as though we were one. At the very same hour, millions of us as one, we start work. Later, millions as one, we stop. And then, like one body with a million hands, at one and the same second, according to the table, we lift the spoon to our lips. And at one and the same second, we leave for a stroll and go to the auditorium, to the hall, for the tailor exercises, and then to bed. I'll be completely honest with you. Even we haven't yet solved the problem of happiness with 100% accuracy. Twice a day, from 16:00 to 17:00, and again from 21:00 to 22:00, the single mighty organism breaks down into its individual cells. These are the personal hours, as established by the table. During these hours, you'll see that some are in their rooms with the blinds modestly lowered. Others are walking along the avenue in step with the brass beat of the march. Still others, like me at this moment, will be at their desks. But I firmly believe, let them call me idealist and dreamer, but I firmly believe that sooner or later, one day, we'll find a place for even these hours in the general formula. One day, all 86,400 seconds will be on the table of hours. I've read and heard a lot of unbelievable stuff about those times when people lived in freedom. That is, in disorganized wildness. But of all things, the very hardest for me to believe was how the government power at that time, even if it was still embryonic, could have permitted people to live without even a semblance of our table, without obligatory walks, without precisely established mealtimes, getting up and going to bed whenever it pleased them. Some historians even claim that in those days lights burned on the streets all night. People were out walking and driving on the streets all night long. Now that's something I simply cannot get through my head. No matter how limited their powers of reason might have been, still they must have understood that living like that was just murder, a capital crime, except it was slow, day-by-day murder. The government, or humanity, would not permit capital punishment for one man, but they permitted the murder of millions a little at a time. To kill one man, that is, to subtract 50 years from the sum of all human lives, that was a crime. But to subtract from the sum of all human lives 50 million years, that was not a crime. No, really, isn't that funny? The problem in moral math could be solved in half a minute by any 10-year-old number today, but they couldn't solve it. All their can'ts together couldn't solve it, because it never occurred to one of their can'ts to construct a system of scientific ethics. That is, one based on subtraction, addition, division, and multiplication. And then, isn't it absurd that a government that had the nerve to call itself a government could let sexual life proceed without the slightest control? Who, when, however much you wanted, completely unscientific, like animals. And blindly like animals, they produced young. Isn't it funny to know horticulture, poultry keeping, fish farming? We have very precise records of their knowing all this, and not to be able to reach the last rung of this logical ladder. Child production, not to come up with something like our maternal and paternal norms. It's so funny, so improbable that now I've written it, I'm afraid that you, my unknown readers, will think I'm making wicked jokes. You might suddenly think I'm making fun of you and keeping a straight face while I tell you the most absolute nonsense. But in the first place, I simply can't make jokes. The default value of every joke is a lie. And in the second place, one state science declares that ancient life was exactly as I have described it. And one state science cannot make a mistake. Besides, where could any government logic have come from anyway when people lived in the condition known as freedom? That is, like beasts, monkeys, cattle. What could you have expected from them? If even in our day you can still very occasionally hear coming up from the bottom, from the hairy depths, a wild ape-like echo. Only now and again, fortunately, these are fortunately no more than little chance details. It's easy to repair them without bringing to a halt the great eternal progress of the whole machine. And in order to discard some bolt that has gotten bent, we have the heavy, skillful hand of the benefactor. We have the experienced eye of the guardians, which, now I think of it, reminds me about that number yesterday with the double bend, like an S. I think I saw him once coming out of the Bureau of Guardians. Now I see why I had that instinctive feeling of respect for him, and why I felt so awkward when that strange 1-330 in his presence. I must confess that 1-330... That's the bell for sleep. It's 22:30. See you tomorrow. Fourth entry. Topics. A savage with a barometer. Epilepsy. If. Up to this point, I have found everything in life clear. Not for nothing do I seem to have a certain partiality for that very word clear. But today, I don't understand. First, I did in fact get an order to be in that very auditorium 112, just as she had told me, although the probability was something like 1,500 over 10 million equals 3 over 20,000. 1,500 is the number of auditoriums, and 10 million the number of numbers. Second, it might be best, however, to go in order. The auditorium, an immense sunlit hemisphere composed of massive glass sections, circular rows of nobly spherical, smoothly shaved heads. I looked around with a slightly sinking heart. I think I was searching whether the pink crescent of my dear O's lips would not shine above the blue waves of the uni's. There, it looked like someone's very white, shiny teeth. But no, not hers. This evening at 21:00 hours, O was to come to my place. It was perfectly natural that I'd want to see her here. The bell. We stood up and sang the anthem of one state, and on the platform appeared the phono lecturer, sparkling with wit and with his golden loudspeaker.
Honored members. Recently, our archaeologists unearthed a book of the 20th century. The author ironically relates the story of the savage and the barometer. The savage noticed that every time the barometer showed rain, it did in fact rain. And since the savage wanted it to rain, he found a way to let out just enough mercury so that the thing would point to rain.
The screen showed a savage bedecked with feathers letting out some mercury. General laughter.
You laugh. But don't you think the European of that age was much more to be laughed at? Just like the savage, the European also wanted rain. But rain with a capital letter, algebraic rain. But he stood in front of the barometer like a wet hen. The savage at least had more daring, more energy, and more, even if savage, logic. He was able to establish a connection between a cause and its effect. When he let that mercury out, he took the first step along the great path that...
But at this point, I repeat, I'm writing what happened, leaving nothing out.
I became for a time impermeable to the vivifying stream pouring out of the loudspeaker. It suddenly struck me that I shouldn't have come. Why shouldn't? And how could I not have come once I'd gotten the order? It suddenly struck me that everything was empty, an empty shell. And I didn't manage to switch my attention back until the phono lecturer had gotten down to his basic theme, to our music, to mathematical composition. The mathematician is the cause, the music the result, to a description of the recently invented musicometer.
Simply by turning this handle, any one of you can produce up to 3 sonatas per hour. And how much labor such a thing cost your ancestors? They could create only by whipping themselves up to attacks of inspiration, some unknown form of epilepsy. And here I have for you a most amusing example of what they got for their trouble. The music of Scriabin, 20th century. This black box.
A curtain was pulled aside on the stage, and there stood one of their ancient instruments.
This black box was called a grand piano, or even a royal grand, which is merely one more proof, if any were needed, of the degree to which all their music.
And then, but again, I'm not sure because it might have been. No, I'll say it right out. Because she, 1-330, went up to the royal grand. I was probably just dazzled by how she suddenly turned up unexpectedly on the stage. She was wearing one of the fantastic costumes of ancient times, a tightly fitting black dress, very low cut, which sharply emphasized the whiteness of her shoulders and bosom, and the warm shadow that undulated in time with her breathing between her. And her blinding, almost wicked teeth. Her smile was a bite, and I was its target. She sat down. She began to play. Something wild, spasmodic, jumbled. Like their whole life back then, when they didn't have even the faintest adumbration of rational mechanics. And of course, those around me were right to laugh, as they all did. But a few of us, and I, why was I among those few? Yes. Epilepsy is a mental illness, pain, a slow, sweet pain. It is a bite. Let it bite deeper, harder. And then, slowly, the sun. Not this one, not ours, shining all sky blue, crystal regularity through the glass brick. No, a savage, rushing, burning sun, flinging everything away from itself, everything in little pieces. The one sitting next to me glanced to his left at me and giggled. For some reason, I have a very vivid image of what I saw. A microscopic bubble of saliva appeared on his lips and burst. That bubble sobered me. I was myself once again. Like everyone else, I heard nothing more than the stupid, vain clattering of the strings. I laughed. Things became easy and simple. The talented phono lecturer had simply given us a too lively picture of that savage epic. That's all. After that, how pleasant it was to listen to our music of today. A demonstration of it was given at the end for contrast. Crystalline, chromatic scales of converging and diverging infinite series, and the synoptic harmonies of the formula of Taylor and Maclaurin, wholesome, quadrangular, as weighty as Pythagoras's pants, mournful melodies of a wavering, diminishing movement, the alternating bright beats of the pauses according to the lines of Fraunhofer, the spectral analysis of the planet. What magnificence! What unalterable regularity! And what pathetic self-indulgence was that ancient music, limited only by its wild imaginings. We left through the broad doors of the auditorium in the usual way, marching 4 abreast in neat ranks. I caught a glimpse of the familiar double-bent figure somewhere to the side and bowed to him respectfully. Dear O was to come in an hour. I felt a pleasant and useful excitement. Once home, I passed quickly by the desk, handed the duty officer my pink ticket, and got the pass to use the blinds. We get to use the blinds only on sex day. Otherwise, we live in broad daylight inside these walls that seem to have been fashioned out of bright air, always on view. We have nothing to hide from one another. Besides, this makes it easier for the guardians to carry out their burdensome, noble task. No telling what might go on otherwise. Maybe it was the strange, opaque dwellings of the ancients that gave rise to their pitiful cellular psychology. My sick home is my castle. Brilliant, right? At 22:00 hours, I lowered the blinds. And at that precise moment, O came in, a little out of breath. She gave me her pink lips and her pink ticket. I tore off the stub, but I couldn't tear myself away from her rosy lips until the very last second at 22:15. Afterward, I showed her my notes and spoke, rather well, I think, about the beauty of the square, the cube, the straight line. She listened in her enchantingly rosy way, and suddenly a tear fell from her blue eyes. Then a second, a third. Right on the page that was open, page 7, made the ink run. So, I'll have to copy it over. Dear D, if only you, if, well, what does that if mean? If what? She was singing that same old tune again, a child, or maybe it was something new about that other one. Though even here it seemed as though, but no, that would be too stupid. Fifth entry. Topics. Square. The rulers of the world. A pleasantly useful function. Wrong again. Again, I'm talking to you, my unknown reader, as though you were, well, say, as though you were my old comrade R13, the poet, the one with the African lips. Everyone knows him. You, meanwhile, you might be anywhere. On the moon, on Venus, on Mars, on Mercury. Who knows you, where you are, and who you are? Here's what. Imagine a square, a splendid living square, and he has to tell you about himself, about his life. You see, the last thing on earth a square would think of telling about is that he has 4 equal angles. He simply does not see that. It's so familiar to him, such an everyday thing. That's me. I'm in the situation of that square all the time. Take the pink tickets and all that. To me, that's nothing more than the 4 equal angles, but for you that might be, I don't know, as tough as Newton's binomial theorem. So, one of the ancient wise men, by accident, of course, managed to say something very smart. Love and hunger rule the world. Ergo, to rule the world, man has got to rule the rulers of the world. Our forebears finally managed to conquer hunger by paying a terrible price. I'm talking about the 200 years war, the war between the city and the country. It was probably religious prejudice that made the Christian savages fight so stubbornly for their bread. But in the year 35, before the founding of one state, our present petroleum food was invented. True, only 0.2 of the world's population survived. On the other hand, when it was cleansed of 1,000 years of filth, how bright the face of the earth became. And what is more, the 0.2-tenths who survived tasted earthly bliss in the granaries of one state. But isn't it clear that bliss and envy are the numerator and denominator of that fraction known as happiness? And what sense would there be in all the numberless victims of the 200 years' war if there still remained in our life some cause for envy? But some cause did remain, because noses remained, the button noses and classical noses mentioned in that conversation on our walk. And because there are some whose love many people want and others whose love nobody wants, it's natural that once hunger had been vanquished, which is algebraically the equivalent of attaining the summit of material well-being, one state mounted an attack on that other ruler of the world, love. Finally, this element was also conquered, i.e., organized, mathematicized, and our lex sexualis was promulgated about 300 years ago. Any number has the right of access to any other number as sexual product. The rest is a purely technical matter. They give you a careful going over in the sexual bureau labs and determine the exact content of the sexual hormones in your blood and work out your correct table of sex days. Then you fill out a declaration that on your days you'd like to make use of number or numbers so-and-so, and they hand you the corresponding book of tickets, pink. And that's it. So it's clear. There's no longer the slightest cause for envy. The denominator of the happiness fraction has been reduced to zero, and the fraction becomes magnificent infinity. And the very same thing that the ancients found to be the source of endless tragedy became for us a harmonious, pleasant, and useful function of the organism, just like sleep, physical work, eating, defecating, and so on. From this, you can see how the mighty power of logic cleanses whatever it touches. Oh, if only you, my unknown readers, could come to know this divine power. If only you, too, could follow it to the end. Strange. Today I've been writing about the loftiest summits of human history. The whole time I've been breathing the purest mountain air of thought. But inside there is something cloudy, something spidery, something cross-shaped like that four-pawed X. Or is it my own paws bothering me? The fact that they've been in front of my eyes so long, these shaggy paws. I don't like talking about them. I don't like them. They're a holdover from the savage era. Can it really be true that I contain? I wanted to cross all that out, because that's beyond the scope of these notes. But then I decided, no, I'll leave it in. Let these notes act like the most delicate seismograph. Let them register the least little wiggles in my brainwaves, however insignificant. Sometimes, you never know, these are just the wiggles that give you the first warning. But that's absurd now. I really should cross it out. We've channeled all the elements of nature. No catastrophe can happen. But now it's perfectly clear to me. That strange inner feeling just comes from my being like the square I spoke about earlier. And there's no X in me. There could not be. I'm simply worried that there might still be some X in you, my unknown readers. But I have faith that you won't judge me too harshly. I have faith that you will understand how hard it is for me to write. Harder than for any other writer in the whole extent of human history. They wrote for their contemporaries. Others wrote for posterity. But nobody ever wrote for their ancestors or for people like their wild, remote ancestors. Sixth entry. Topics. An incident. The damned. It's clear. 24 hours. I repeat, I've imposed on myself the duty of writing without holding anything back. So, sad as it may be, I have to record here that apparently even we haven't yet finished the process of hardening and crystallizing life. The ideal is still a long way off. The ideal, this is clear, is that state of affairs where nothing ever happens anymore, but with us, here, just have a look at this. Today I read in the State Gazette that 2 days from now there will be a justice gala in Cube Square. So that means that once again some number has interfered with the progress of the great state machine. Again, something unforeseen, unaccounted for in advance, has gone ahead and happened. And what is more, something has happened to me. True, this happened during the personal hour. That is to say, during the time specially set aside for unforeseen circumstances, but still.
at about 16:00 hours, or to be precise, at 15:50. I was at home. Suddenly, the phone rang.
D-503?
Yes.
You free?
Yes.
It's me, 1-330. I'll fly by for you and we'll go to the ancient house, okay?
1-330, that woman annoys me, repels me, almost scares me. But for that very reason, I said, yes. 5 minutes later, we were already in the Arrow, moving to the sky of the month of May. Its blue majolica and the light sun was zooming along behind us in its own golden arrow, keeping up but never passing. But there ahead of us, we could see the white cataract of a cloud, a stupid downy thing like the cheek of some antique Cupidon. And that somehow bothered me. The forward window was raised, and the wind dried your lips so that you kept running your tongue over them, which made you constantly think about lips. Soon you could see in the distance the cloudy green spots, over there, beyond the wall. Then your heart jumps into your throat. Nothing you can do about it, and you sink down, 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 like a steep fall downhill. And you're at the ancient house. This entire strange, rickety, godforsaken structure is clad all about in a glass shell. Otherwise, of course, it would have collapsed long ago. At the glass door was an old woman wrinkled all over, especially her mouth. Nothing but wrinkles, pleats, her lips already gone inside, her mouth kind of grown over, and it was against all odds that she could speak. But she spoke.
Well, my dears, have you come to see my little house?
And her wrinkles shone. That is, they probably folded together in such a way as to look like rays, but it made the impression of shining.
Yes, Granny. Felt like it again,
said 1-330. The wrinkles glowed.
What sun we have today. Isn't it something, though? Such a tease. Such a tease. But I know. It's all right. You can go ahead by yourselves. I'd better stay here, in the sun.
My companion seems to come here often. I keep feeling I'd like to brush something off me, something bothering me. It's probably that same visual image that I can't shake off, that cloud on the smooth blue of the Majolica. As we were going up the wide, dark staircase, 1-330 said,
I love her, that old woman.
What for?
I don't know. Maybe for her mouth. Maybe for nothing at all. I just do.
I shrugged my shoulders. She went on with a sort of smile, or maybe it wasn't a smile.
I feel very guilty. It's clear that one shouldn't love just because, but because of. All our natural impulses should be.
It's clear, I began, then cut myself at the word and stole a glance at 1-330 to see whether she'd noticed. She was looking down at something. Her eyes were lowered like blinds. I thought suddenly of how you walk along the avenue around 22:00 hours, and among the brightly lit cages there are some dark ones with the blinds lowered. What was going on there in her head, behind her blinds? Why had she phoned me today, and what was all this? I opened a heavy, squeaking, solid door, and we found ourselves in a gloomy, untidy place, which they used to call an apartment. It contained that same strange royal instrument as well as a riot of colors and forms that were just as wild and disorganized and crazy as their music. The upper surface was a white plain. The walls were a dark blue. Old books were bound in red, green, and orange. The candelabra was of yellow bronze, a statue of Buddha, and the lines of the furniture made lopsided ellipses that could never be accommodated in any conceivable equation. I could hardly stand this chaos. But my companion apparently had a stronger constitution.
This is my absolute favorite.
And then she suddenly seemed to catch herself, and there was that incisive smile, those sharp white teeth, and she went on.
I mean to say, the absolute stupidest of their so-called apartments.
Or to be more precise, I said, of their states.
Thousands of microscopic, eternally belligerent, merciless states like... Oh, yes, of course. That's clear,
said she, seemingly quite serious.
We walked through a room containing small beds for children. Children were also private property in that era.
And there were more rooms, flashing mirrors, gloomy chests, sofas covered in unbearably clashing fabrics, huge fireplaces, an immense mahogany bed. What we have now, our splendid, transparent, eternal glass, could be seen nowhere except in their pathetic little rickety rectangular windows.
And just think, here they loved just because they burned, they tormented themselves.
Again, she lowered the blinds of her eyes.
What an idiotic, what a wasteful expense of human energy, don't you think?
It was as though she were speaking with my voice, putting my thoughts into words. But her smile always contained that irritating X. There behind her blinds, something, I have no idea what, was going on in her, something that made me lose all patience. I wanted to argue with her, yell at her, exactly that, yell. But I had to agree. It was impossible not to agree. And now we stopped in front of the mirror. At that moment, all I could see were her eyes. An idea hit me. The way the human body is built, it's just as stupid as those apartments. Human heads are opaque and there's no way to see inside except those tiny little windows, the eyes. She seemed to guess what I was thinking and turned around.
Well, here are my eyes. What do you think?
Without actually saying this, of course. I saw before me two ominous dark windows, and inside there was another life, unknown. All I could see was a flame. There was some sort of fireplace inside, and some figures that looked... That would be natural, of course. What I saw there was my own reflection. But it was not natural and did not look like me. Apparently, the surroundings were having a depressing effect. I felt absolutely afraid. I felt trapped, shut into that wild cage. I felt myself swept into the wild whirlwind of ancient life.
You know what?
She said.
Go into the next room for a minute.
Her voice came from there inside, from behind the windows of her eyes, where the fire was burning. I went out and sat down. On a little bracket on the wall was a bust of one of their ancient poets, Pushkin, I think. His asymmetrical, snub-nosed face was looking straight at me with a barely detectable smile. Why am I sitting here? Why am I meekly putting up with this smile? And what is all this anyway? What am I doing here? How did this ridiculous situation arise? That irritating, repellent woman, this weird game. Inside, the door of the chest banged. There was the rustle of silk, and I had a hard time making myself not go in there, and I don't know what I was thinking. Probably I meant to say some very sharp things to her. But she'd already come out. She was wearing an old-fashioned dress, short, bright yellow, and had on a black hat and black stockings. The dress was made of a very thin silk. I could clearly see that the stockings were long and came way above her knees. And the neck was cut very low with that shadow between her. Listen, I said, it's clear that you want to show off your originality, but do you really have to...
It's clear,
she broke in,
that to be original means distinguish yourself from others. It follows that to be original is to violate the principle of equality, and what the ancients called in their idiotic language being banal is what we call just doing your duty, because...
I couldn't control myself. Yes, yes, yes. That's exactly right, and you've got no business. She went up to the bust of the snub-nosed poet and, lowering the blinds to cover the wild fire behind the windows of her eyes,
said something that, for once at least, struck me as completely serious. To calm me down, maybe. She said a very reasonable thing.
Don't you think it's surprising that people were once willing to put up with someone like this one here? And not only put up with him, they adored him. What a slavish mentality. Don't you agree?
It's clear, that is, I mean, damn that, clear, I keep saying.
Oh, of course I understand. But the fact is, you know, that people like him were rulers with more power than those who actually wore the crown. Why weren't they isolated and wiped out? In our world.
Yes, in our world. I had only begun when she burst out laughing. I didn't hear the laugh, only saw it with my eyes. I saw the curve of that laugh, ringing, steep, resilient, and lively as a whip. I remember how I was trembling all over. I should have, I don't know, grabbed her and what? I don't remember. But I felt I had to, I don't know, do something. What I did was mechanically open up my gold badge and look at the watch. It was 16:50. Don't you think it's time to go? I said as politely as I could.
And suppose I asked you to stay here with me?
Listen, are you aware of what you're saying? In 10 minutes, I'm supposed to be in the auditorium.
And it is the obligation of all numbers to follow the prescribed course in art and the sciences,
said 1-330, mimicking my own voice. Then she raised the blinds, lifted her eyes, and I saw the fire burning behind those windows.
In the Bureau of Medicine, there is a doctor I know. He's assigned to me, and if I ask, he'll make out a certificate for you that you were sick. How about it?
I understood. At last, I understood where this whole game was leading. So that's how it is. And you know that what I should do, basically, like any honest number, is head for the Bureau of Guardians immediately and...
And not just basically.
This with one of her smile bites.
I'm really terribly curious. Are you or aren't you going to the Bureau?
You're staying? I said as I reached for the handle of the door. The handle was made of brass, and my voice sounded to me like it was made of the same brass.
Just a minute. Do you mind?
She went to the telephone, made a call, and spoke to some number. I didn't catch who he was. I was so upset.
I'll wait for you at the ancient house,
she shouted.
Yes, yes, I'll be alone.
I turned the cold brass handle. Will you let me take the arrow?
Oh, of course. Please.
At the entrance, the old woman was dozing in the sun like a plant. Once more, I was surprised that her mouth seemed to appear out of some undergrowth and produce speech.
And your... what's her name? She's staying on by herself?
Yes, by herself. The old woman's mouth sank out of sight again. She shook her head. Apparently, even her feeble brain understood how stupid and dangerous that woman's behavior was. I got to the lecture precisely at 17:00. Just then, for some reason, it struck me that I'd told the old woman a lie. 1-330 was not alone there now. I didn't mean to, but I misinformed the old woman. Maybe that was what preyed on my mind and kept me from hearing the lecture. No, she was not alone. That was just the trouble. After 21:30, I had a free hour. There was still time today to go make my report to the Bureau of Guardians, but I was so tired after that idiotic business. And then, too, you have 2 days by law to make the report. I'd still have time tomorrow, a whole 24 hours. Thank you for listening to this sample. To continue listening to this book and for access to all of our other full audiobooks, please subscribe for $7.77 per month. Go to adultbrain.ca or follow the link in the show notes. This will be a completely separate podcast with a new RSS feed and will have all the titles from this feed as well. Thank you for your help and support in bringing rare and forgotten books to audio for the world.